financial independence, country shopping, van nomadism, security culture, ethical enclaves, crypto anarchy, legal interstices, survivalism. Join your hosts, Shane and Kyle, as they explore this freedom strategy known as Vonage. You're listening to the Vonu Podcast.
And welcome to the Vonu Podcast, the podcast making you invulnerable to coercion. I'm Shane and...
I'm Kyle, and since governments are the primary coercers upon individuals, the Vonu Podcast is covered by BIPCOT No Government License. Reuse and modification is permitted to anyone, except for governments and the agents thereof. You can learn more at BIPCOT.org.
So, Kyle, you know... By the time the listeners will hear this, you know, it'll already be a month past, you know, 4th of July, or, you know, as I like to call it, Anarchy Day weekend. It'll be about a month past that by the time the listeners hear this, but we're finally getting our reserves back. So, you know, I do want to talk about that. There are a couple of things I think would be worthy of mentioning on my end, but yeah, how was your Anarchy Day weekend?
Let's see. I was working a 10-hour day, so I was thoroughly enmeshed in the servile society, and people were wishing me, coworkers mainly, wishing me a happy 4th of July. There was red, white, and blue cupcakes in the break room. They laid it on really thick. Even like the cheering, like at the, or the clapping, cheering thing, like you see at some Walmart employees do or whatever. Occasionally that'll happen at the beginning of my shifts or whatever. And this time, instead of the normal cheer, it was USA, USA. And that was actually, I think, probably the first time I deliberately just skipped out on a meeting. I didn't get in trouble with the acting manager, but suffice it to say, people took notice, and I later told different people, yeah, this is not my favorite holiday. Would you like to learn why?
So you didn't want to participate in cult worship?
No. I drew a... What's the phrase the Patriots like to use? A line in the sand, I suppose. And only one of my coworkers honestly wanted to know why I did that the way that I did. So basically, I gave him the short version of Patrick Henry is my favorite founding father, and he didn't even like the Constitution. Kind of took it from there. So.
Gotcha. Yeah. Well. Obviously, you know, this is the same kind of sort of stuff happened where I was. I mean, it was, you know, that was the holiday, you know, 4th of July. But I was playing beer pong during fireworks, and someone wanted to, you know, put on like, you know, the patriotic music and such. My dad was putting that on. I was like, what is this nonsense that you're putting on? He's like, Shane, shut up. But yeah. So it's kind of the similar. He wasn't mad. He was just, yeah, he wouldn't have done it. Someone wanted him, and he's a pleaser when it comes to being down there. But yeah, I mean, obviously that same sort of stuff. But you know, it's kind of ironic. So obviously here in the communist state of Illinois, you know, governments like to, you know, overspend, or governments don't hold a budget. Why would they? Right? It's not their fucking money. So in Illinois, there's a proposal of like a 32% income tax hike, and got through the House and the Senate, but it got but Governor Rauner said no, not going to happen. But you know, that didn't. I don't think that had already taken place yet. But yeah, you know, everyone on 4th of July, you know, celebrating freedom and independence, they're bitching about taxes. And it's like just the pure irony. So they're like, okay. And what are you celebrating today? Oh yeah, right. Okay. Interesting. So I don't know, controlled schizophrenia maybe a little bit.
Oh yeah. That definitely sounds like it, right? You know, much like how it was mentioned back in season 1. Regarding the tax thing specifically, it was like, oh, you know, he'll pay his income taxes, but the controlled schizophrenic will also take advantage of as many tax deductions as possible and reduce that tax liability, right?
Right. I just thought it was super ironic. It really was.
Oh yeah, and it was also like the radio at work too. It was Star Spangled Banner kind of stuff. I mean, it was really laying on thick. And at one point, I almost completely lost it. And I just said, you know what, everybody? I said this loud on the floor. I said, you know what? The hypothetically limited government ain't so limited. You know, oh, people really turned
They probably didn't know what the hell you were talking about.
what's limited government? It's like, oh, that's what America is based on. That's what like committees of safety were based on. You know, that like the classical liberalism much. Oh no! It's democracy. It's our constitutional republic.
But yeah, no, I'm certainly there with you. It was obviously it was frustrating, but at the same time, you know, I was in the other podcast I do, I was talking to Jason about this, and my perspective has changed. You know, it's not so much about bring people to this philosophy. It's kind of like most people don't want to be free. They don't want to take responsibility for their freedom. So people ask, I want to talk about it, sure, but I'm there to have fun.
Yeah.
I'm not there to participate in their nonsense. So
yeah, but unfortunately, when I was at work, it was an issue of not just, I have to be there to work, which is why I'm there in the first place. But it was also an issue of you really should participate. And it was more of a sharp line of you participate in our cultural servile society. And I just said, you know what? No. And thankfully, I didn't get in trouble, but I did turn a couple heads.
Well, that's good. I mean, that you're able to, not participate and not get in trouble.
That would have really
sucked if they're like, all right, and they disciplined you because of it.
Yeah. Well, that's like a free speech issue at that point, right? One's conscience in terms of political matters, or in my case, anti-political. On a good note, though, there were two guys when I was on my official break, according to Texas labor laws. That's an actual legal term, apparently. When I was on my break in the break room. I talked to like two guys about Bitcoin, and one of them was seriously interested in getting started. So there was
right on.
So there was that. I mentioned about how wicked the Federal Reserve was. I went on a lecture. And he's like, but wait a minute, today's 4th of July.
Whoops.
Yeah, and I said, well, at least with Bitcoin, it's something tangible instead of a constitution and a bill of rights that doesn't actually protect your freedom. Just look at the various gun control measures here. And remember, folks, I live in Texas, so anything with gun control, really kind of people actually get upset about that here, even in Austin. So thank
you. Know your audience.
Yep, exactly. So, and I also mentioned like some people, I also kind of threw in a little thing on there like, oh yeah, some people have also bought guns using Bitcoin. And he got really excited and it was like, yeah.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, but no, there are coworkers I've got who don't even know what Bitcoin is. So whether somebody thinks of it as good or bad or neutral, they didn't even know what it is. Oh, but they were more than happy to tell me about Kim Kardashian just the other week.
Oh yeah. Yeah, the entertainment of the servile society. Yep.
Yep. So that's kind of where things were as far as this past Anarchy Day goes. It's just kind of like democracy, America, not even really the Constitution, which was interesting. I was waiting for somebody to mention
that. It's never about the Constitution. It never is. It's always like this really abstract, like, freedom, independence, the symbols of freedom. But no one actually knows what the supposed freedom is actually, supposedly guaranteed by, the Constitution. That's not brought up. Because I remember a couple of years back, it was for 4th of July, and I was going to do some grand thing, down there at the ground, and I was going to, burn a flag. And I decided against it, but I was like, I bet if I burnt a Constitution, no one would bat an eye.
Nobody would bat
like,
an eye.
Like, I bet no one would care at all.
And you see, the funny thing is that the flag is actually not mentioned in the Constitution at all. I checked. I study the thing. I should know what it is.
Well, no, the flag's from like 1949 or 1959, right? It was long after the ratification.
Well, yeah, the current version of it. But I'm even saying even the Betsy Ross about the original 13 colonies. What the Tea Partiers reappropriated during 2008 and 9 and so forth. Last time I checked, not even the Betsy Ross is mentioned in the Constitution, but it is mentioned in Title IV United States Code, which of course is the statutory law which Congress passed and all that. So it's not the flag is not constitutional, period. It's like the flag is like the cops. Neither of them are in the Constitution, but hey, the hypothetically limited government ain't so limited. So let's leave it there.
I guess the flag is just a symbol of the state, and the cops, they are a symbol of the state too. But you don't see too many individuals beaten down by flags. So I guess maybe that's a kind of stark contrast there. But anyways, I guess one other note there is. So I've been going down, every single holiday, Kyle, this by now. It's like, oh, it's holidays coming. What are you doing? Oh, yeah, right. You're going camping and riding. Yeah, I know. You even know that now, Kyle. But I've been going down there for 25 years, and there was one cop there, one sheriff. My dad called him because we had a couple four-wheelers stolen. He had to file a police report for insurance. So that was, he did what he had to do, I guess. And then, other than that, like, there's never been any cops there. But on the 4th of July, some people that were riding down there, some of my parents' friends, Apparently, you know, someone, you know, related or friend or family of like one of the people they brought there was actually a bludgie, narcotics officer. So, yeah, I found that out and I was like, okay, I'm a little uncomfortable. I'm just going to go hang out by myself over here.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was a kind of a, you know, a negative situation there. But, you know, I was the only one that, that really, you know, took notice and really cared. But yeah, you know, I don't like being around cops, which is why I don't hang out with my entire, like, mom's side of the family. It's because, you know, they're DHS agents and canine officers and such. It's just not fun to be around them.
Yeah, and not only that, I can double, triple, and second that or whatever. I mean, I don't like being around lawyers. I don't like being around prosecutors. I don't like being around judges. So, yeah, basically anybody who is, and I especially don't like being around bureaucrats. Because at least with a cop, at least it's kind of like, you know, generally speaking, unless they're doing an undercover gig, at least they're uniformed and they're there and it's like, oh, there's a bludgie, right? But you can't quite do that with a bureaucrat because they usually wear suits and ties or something similar. At least with a judge, you can at least kind of identify them by the robes, but they're not out on the streets, right? They're pretty much stuck in courtrooms. Mm-hmm. So sometimes when judges are not on the bench, but they're like living their own lives or, as you're kind of saying, maybe even at a family function, they're otherwise wearing normal clothes in some sense, right? I don't think they're wearing their judge's robes at a family barbecue.
No, I doubt it.
Right. So yes, I mean, I don't want to hang out with cops either. I think the only type of government employee that I might be okay with, maybe at some sort of social function, would be active duty soldiers who already have filed their paperwork where they're not going to be reenlisted.
Or mailmen, and they don't openly violate your rights.
Yeah, but the mailman may be like a government civil servant bureaucrat type for the, like the next 40 years. I'm saying if somebody's like an active duty soldier, but they're already filed the paperwork to already get out of the military. Those guys I'll hang out with, and I've done that before. That and veterans, because they're at that point there's not really much of a distinction. But that's why I had the caveat. Once they file the paperwork, because remember, the military is a bureaucracy too. It's also a welfare program. Different topic for another time. But yeah. Because of the bureaucracy, it takes...
Don't say that on the 4th of July.
Oh, I almost did. But I didn't want to piss off everybody else more than I already did. But yeah, man. Once those soldiers have filed their paperwork and they're getting out... then they're kind of like one or two steps away from being a veteran. And usually if there are veterans around, military veterans, I usually hang around those guys anyway because they seem kind of okay, sort of. I mean, depending which ones you're kind of getting mixed up with. But yeah, if somebody's like active duty, you know, because of Posse Comitatus and a few other things, you know, they can't directly hurt me.
Right, yeah.
You know, judges, prosecutors, cops, definitely yes. Bureaucrats, definitely yes. Legislators, indirectly, they can hurt me, but not directly. Soldiers, not allowed to touch me ever. So if there's any type of government employee I'm going to hang out with at a social function, more likely than not, it would probably be soldiers because they're actually the least threatening to me.
Fair enough. I can get that. But anyways, so this episode is titled Strategic Relocation, Seeking Out the Promised Land of Liberty. And the show notes can be found at VonnePodcast.com/21. And this episode will launch our second mini-series for this second season thus far, which will focus on strategies presented by Rayo that involve, you know, the actual physical relocation to another geographical area or areas plural. So, Kyle, let's go ahead and get the definitions out of the way. You're in the hot seat today. So what is strategic relocation?
All right. So strategic relocation is defined as... the practice of finding and assessing the relative safety of geographical areas from threats, whether natural or artificial, with the intention of physically moving there in order to enjoy better long-term security. So in other words, strategic relocation is not just, oh, you know, I looked at the cost of living adjustments, the COLAs, if you will. And we may or may not have some family nearby. Okay, honey, let's move like five states across, you know, the country or whatever to someplace and we'll settle down there. No, strategic relocation is more careful than that. It's more focused on, again, defending yourself from threats and trying to anticipate potential threats and trying to move to an area where that minimizes those threats, hence relative safety. So the actual term and concept itself could as far as I'm aware of, was more or less codified and loosely defined, not concisely defined like I just did a moment ago, but loosely codified or defined by Joel Skousen in a book of his by the same name, the first edition of which was in 1997. The third current edition came out in 2010. So apparently the guy should know what he's talking about when it comes to strategic relocation. However, as this episode is about Rayo, and what he was mainly writing about and all that, consider that when he wrote about, I guess you could say, trying to move to a different place in order to have a better, wait for it, invulnerability to coercion, to have better Vanu, he was writing this in the early 70s. So in other words, Rayo was already essentially practicing strategic relocation before it was defined as such, more or less, by Skousen, like 20 some odd years earlier.
Yeah, and I guess one other note there too is, you know, keep in mind that Rayo, you know, did the strategic relocation thing in the early 60s with Van Nomadism. So like Rayo, you know, did it and wrote about it and all that. And I'm not sure what Joel Skousen does. You know, last I heard he was in the United States, but you know, maybe I'm wrong on that. I don't know. But you know, Rayo, you know, was doing that was what he did. That was what he was kind of like known for, the neo-nomadic lifestyles. So I figured that was worth pointing out there.
Yes, it is. And so yes, the current modern concept of strategic relocation, I think is worthwhile, hence this episode we're doing on it. However, I think it's also important to point out that Rayo really got this down to a T and developed it well before Skousen or anybody even knew about Skousen. So that's kind of the takeaway here, as is many of our other episodes, Shane, especially this season, right, where we're like somebody else is more or better well known in like this one particular technique or this particular topic, and then we find out, oh wait a minute, Rayo did it like decades earlier.
Yeah, right.
So that kind of seems to be a recurring theme, and same thing here with strategic relocation.
Yeah, and obviously we'll get more into this, but I guess just as a preliminary question, because I did find out about another one of these. I'm not going to, you know, drop any names here for security purposes, but there was, you know, some people are, I guess, apparently some people are going to be, you know, relocating to, you know, some state in the Midwest to set up an intentional community. Would that be considered, you mentioned, you know, that if you're just moving five states over for, you know, family purposes and for, you know, cost of living adjustments and all that, would, you know, moving somewhere to set up an intentional community, would that be considered strategic relocation, even if it's just a few states away?
I would say it would really kind of depend on what the intention on what the intention and the goals were. But generally speaking, and much like that episode we did earlier this season on intentional communities, if the people establishing an intentional community are doing so as per the definition of strategic relocation, the practice of finding and assessing the relative safety of geographical areas from threats, whether natural or artificial, with the intention of physically moving there in order to enjoy better long-term security, then yes. But remember, not everybody who sets up an intentional community actually cares about having better long-term security. So I think that's the distinction here, because anybody can set up an intentional community, generally speaking, and most right. of them fail as far as you know, my understanding goes. Again, for the listeners, please see previous episode on intentional communities. But with strategic relocation, it's in many ways very much in the spirit of Vanu, because the idea is to become more invulnerable to coercion, and strategic relocation is a way of trying to do that by just simply voting with your feet, with the view of mitigating risk and minimizing threats.
Right. Okay, and this next one, so the chapter that we'll, you know, or the article that we'll be, you know, kind of focusing on, or at least, you know, in the beginning of this episode, will be called A Survey of the Siskiyou Region. You know, that's probably, a little odd for some folks, especially those who don't live out, you know, in the Northwest. So let's go ahead and define that. What is, you know, the Siskiyou Region? What was Rayo talking about when he said that?
Okay, so pretty much more or less from Rayo himself, he didn't want to recognize any really American governments. So instead of saying Southwestern Oregon and Northern California, it was just simply relabeling it to the Siskiyou region. So for this episode, when we say the Siskiyou region is defined as Southwestern Oregon and Northern California.
Okay, very good, very good. So let's go ahead and get into you know what Rayo had to say. And again, this is from a survey of Siskiyou Region. It's an article in his book that you can get for free in PDF or audiobook format. If you're a new listener, you can get that at VonnePodcast.com. Definitely recommend you do. And this is one of the longer articles. He goes through a lot of stuff, and trust me, it was you know awful to type up and awful to narrate. So it's a longer article. But let's see what he had to say. Quote, well, there are a few people in the backcountry. There are enough in the larger trading centers for comparative anonymity. Everyone doesn't know everyone else. And these trading centers are close enough at hand so that transportation isn't a big problem. Furthermore, San Francisco, Los Angeles, or Portland are only a day's drive away. For these reasons, Vanu is easier for small groups to achieve in Siskiyou than in a more remote region such as Yukon. And Siskiyou is the safest region in the U.S. in event of a nuclear war. It is upwind and away from major targets, end quote. So, obviously, Rayo had some concerns he was trying to mitigate. Obviously, the nuclear war came up again. That was something he was actually worried about. It was one thing he defended against. It wasn't his focus, like some of the doomsday preppers that you'll see today, especially on your government television. I guess one of the major points here that he made was, out in Siskiyou, you can remain, very private, but in larger trading centers, you do have that anonymity, that invulnerability to coercion, and that is, done through, just blending into the environment. So, Kyle, what do you think?
I would first stress that people keep in mind that episode we did back in season one about the Servile Society, and more specifically, the related concept about import-export. That's what Rayo is directly applying here, is the concept of import-export, or what was also described as a form of one-directional isolation. So in other words, notice that he's kind of describing here where he's also described elsewhere as kind of having access to the Servile Society's open but not free trading centers. And it's for reasons of survivability, because simply we, meaning the Vanuans, don't quite have enough infrastructure to make our own stuff yet, at least certain types of things, therefore import-export with the Servile Society and all that. So regarding these trading centers that he's mentioning here, especially San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Portland being a day's drive away, he's making an argument in favor of the practicality of import-export in this particular region.
I would definitely agree. Let's continue here. So, quote, despite the mild climate, there is relatively little agriculture. Not only is level land limited to a few river valleys, but the soil is leached in the winter and baked in summer. Even in the Rogue Valley, most crops need irrigation and fertilization. East of the Cascades, there isn't the leaching problem, but irrigation water is scarce. Even stock raising is not very extensive west of the Cascades. Grasses are poor in minerals, hay, and alfalfa are tucked in to supplement local forage, end quote. So obviously what he's talking about here is, it's probably, especially for, the folks that are looking for more, self-sufficiency and looking to, at least eliminate some of the need for the import-export. Obviously being able to raise agriculture might be, a very important thing. If you can, grow your own food, have your have some cattle or some pigs or whatever, that'd be good. And one of the main things, with this article, a survey of the Siskiyou region, is Rayo covers, for those who are interested in this, he provides a great example of what things you need to look into if you're going to do this. So he covered the food right there, the agricultural aspect of it. He also covers the temperature, the climate, terrain, precipitation, the best places to buy food in the area. What equipment is necessary to, wilderness fauna in the Siskiyou region, and just a whole slew of other things. So apparently in the Siskiyou, maybe agriculture may not be, very good, but apparently, advantages, outweigh that disadvantage, I suppose.
Yes. And so, like, one thing that people really need to think about when considering how to really be self-sufficient or more self-sufficient is agricultural productivity. In other words, how easy, relatively speaking, how easy is it to grow food in some areas relative to others? And what kinds of crops can grow easier in some areas relative to others? And so, yeah, if there's like soil erosion problems, or as Rayo mentioned here about soil being leached and so forth, that's going to be a problem. And heck, I mean, when he mentions about irrigation water being scarce, That is extremely serious. I mean, that's desert conditions when you talk about irrigation water being scarce.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, that is true. Anything else?
Well, I would just kind of say that regarding this particular article, we're not going to do a lot of direct quotes, but I do think it's important to at least try and paraphrase and condense a lot of the very, very detailed information Rayo gave regarding his observations on the Siskiyou region. And the reason why I think that's important is that I think there have been, especially for people who listened to our earlier episode this season on local congregations, I think there have been overly eager attitudes in terms of voting with your feet. And I understand while that comes from a good place, it's very ill-advised. And so what strategic relocation encourages is that instead of just voting with your feet based on emotions and based on, well, there's all this great hype and let's go join the Free State Project or whatever, you know, stupid idea is being promoted this week. Instead, it's like, well, wait, hold on, everybody slow the heck down. Let's, you know, go through this, you know, step by step and think about what life is going to be like, or at least try to, and try to get some information about, you know, whether it's the climate or the social environment or whatever else, and then see if it's a good fit for you. Because, I mean, keep in mind, too, that in terms of where you are living, in a lot of ways, it comes down to lifestyle preferences, right? I mean, not everybody is a desert rat. Some people like living in swamps. Look at Florida. Other people prefer to be frozen most of the year. Please see Upper Midwest, Northeast, and heck, pretty much a lot of Canada.
Yep. Yeah, no, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. There are a lot of considerations that need to be, you know, taken into account. I mean, that's just how it is. That's how it is if you're going to do it, you know, wisely. And you know, it costs some money, you know, to you know, like if you make a mistake and you move out to you know, New Hampshire, and you say, well, darn, you know, I like Arizona better. Well, what are you going to do? You have to, you know, travel all the way back down there and, you know, restart your life. So I mean, yeah, it's better to not plan to the extent that you never do it, but, you know, at least have some of the preparations in place, and also, you know, look into it and see if it's really something that you would be interested in. And I guess one other kind of thing I want to mention here. So the editor of Rayo's book, his name was John Fisher, and you know, John Fisher had a couple of books of his own on Lumpanics Unlimited, and one of them is The Last Frontiers on Earth: Strange Places Where You Can Live Free, and the other is Uninhabited Ocean Islands. So there's, I mean, these books are all about strategic relocation. That's just what they are. I mean, these are the whole point of the book. And hell, you know, John Fisher even dedicates dedication to Rayo, who walked this trail before any of us thought of it. So, you know, John Fisher was, you know, definitely, you know, close with Rayo, at least until the disappearance. But I will say, like, as far as, you know, the value of these books, as far as, you know, strategic relocation, like for you, if you're interested in it, may not be a whole lot of value. May not be. And I'll just, you know, be honest with you right there. But what it did for me when I read them was it, you know, it got my mind, you know, it got me thinking. Okay, so these are possibilities too. Well, what about this? Huh? Well, what about that? So they're definitely good in, you know, I guess, spurring kind of that thought. And I guess to provide a little more detail here as far as, you know, why they may not be very valuable. I don't know about you, Kyle, but, you know, one whole section of this book is living in the polar regions. You know, I don't see myself moving to Antarctica, do you?
No, at least not yet. But I don't want to rule stuff out before I had a chance to really look into it. Let me put it this way. I am experienced with living outside wearing layers upon layers of clothing back during my Boy Scout days. So no, Antarctica is not my first choice, but I don't want to rule it out either.
Understood. And another part, live on the ocean, which, you know, I found that very valuable. He was the guy that, you know, and we'll get into this, you know, next week, the International Waters Line. Yeah, he was the one that got me thinking on that, and now, you know, I've gotten a lot more information on that subject. Living as a nomad, whether walking, bicycle, canoe, horse, you know, most of those things aren't very, you know, attractive to me, might be for you. And then living in other unusual places like a secret cellar, a ghost town, cavern, or the desert. So depending upon what you're looking for, you know, maybe there would be something of value for you there. But like I said, for me, it was mostly just, you know, getting me thinking, and especially when it came to, you know, Finding Freedom on the Open Ocean. That was the book that really kind of spurred it. And as far as Uninhabited Ocean Islands, it's an interesting, interesting read. And pretty much, you know, as per the title, you can probably imagine what the subject of the book is. But pretty much here, I will say, you know, The Last Frontiers on Earth is more of an engaging read, more exciting. But this one is literally just like we mentioned, you know, in that survey of Siskiyou region, you know, like he goes through all of this stuff. Like he went through like the latitude and longitude lines, like maps that you might need. He went through like all of the locations where you'd get food and just a bunch of stuff, you know, that was kind of tedious and you may not be relevant or, you know, just details that, you know, aren't very interesting. But yeah, he just goes through, you know, Pacific Ocean, warm islands, sub-Antarctic islands, Pacific sector, Atlantic Ocean islands, Indian Ocean islands, et cetera, et cetera. And he just kind of lays out like, okay, here's where this is. Here's the vegetation you might expect. Here's what governments are doing on it, if anything. Go have fun if this is where you want to go. And I guess one other one other note is, you know, John Fisher, you know, I think he was a lot like Rayo in the sense that when he talked about, you know, the strategic relocation stuff, he actually did it. He was far too intimately familiar with some of the details of living on an iceberg. So, you know... Interesting reads for sure, and they will get you thinking. So I would recommend you can still pick up copies of those on Amazon, maybe for like $10 a pop, maybe something like that. They're cheap books. So you know, I would recommend those, and they go right along with what we're talking about today with strategic relocation.
Well, I think something to really kind of emphasize here is that the type of material that one would have to learn or at least just read just from start to finish regarding strategic relocation, I'm going to be perfectly honest with you folks. It is not a novel, okay? It's not supposed to be gripping, exciting, dramatic action. Think of it more like dry data. It's significant and important, but it's not like a thrilling story. It's not entertainment. These are facts which you have to kind of sift through and make sense of and decide what you're basically going to be risking your life on, depending about how adventurous you're going to be and such. Some areas are more riskier than others and so forth. So, for example, I'll just paraphrase. Rayo did go into some detail, as you mentioned a moment, Shane, not just about latitude and longitude, like regarding topographic maps, but he also went into detail too about like where to buy food. And so he was like recommending, he literally had like this long list of, and this is right in the Survey of the Siskiyou Region article. He had this long list of different places he was buying food and gave addresses so people can just kind of show up. And he's like, well, like at this place, it has fair prices on this kind of staple, you know, for so many cents per pound or whatever. Keep in mind, this was in the 70s, adjusted for inflation, all that. And then like at other places, he would say that, well, you know, this place is overpriced, but it's good for people who really like being on food stamps.
Yeah, so he was kind of freaks. Yeah, is what he called them.
Right. So. There's quite a bit of information in here that, in a sense, is valuable to us only in the context of it being like historically relevant. However, it would be more relevant in a more modern like context, like you and I who are actually still breathing, in the sense that if we were to emulate how Rayo conducted, if we were to emulate Rayo's example and how to do strategic relocation, then it would be at that point just trying to basically kind of get it down to more of like something resembling a formula. And that would be more appropriate for season 3, by the way, before I forget, mm-hmm. would be like, what would be the formula for like strategic relocation and what kind of that dry data needs to be in there. And as far as like this episode goes, there are some constants. So anything with the weather, that does seem to be rather important. So temperature, climate, terrain, precipitation, that all kind of seems to be relevant. Something interesting that kind of Skousen more brings to the table would be things more of like a social nature, where he's mentioning things about like traffic flows, local politics in terms of like city councils and how oppressive are the property taxes. Actually, one point of commonality between Rayo and Skousen is that both of them were concerned, almost in a Cold War sense, both of them concerned about nuclear strike targets. And so the idea being that in order to mitigate your risk of being, Rayo called it nuclear incineration, right? in order to lower that risk, maybe you should pick to living in an area, a region where you have the least amount of nuclear strike targets. So probably exactly, shouldn't. Yeah. So in other words, for example, probably shouldn't live right next door to an army base or an air force base or something where they're actually going to have nukes. Or even if they don't have nukes, some sort of government installation that a foreign government might find intriguing to send to Hades, as it were.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Anything else there? Or because there's an interesting chapter Rayo had on acquisition of private property. So I do think that is relevant here, but, you know, before we get to that, do you have any other closing thoughts there?
I would just say that when people decide to really learn about strategic relocation, really from any source, it's more important to take your time and do it right. And if you need to, you know, if you need to make a pot of coffee and really kind of take your time and go through the details, then do that. But if there was any one type of method of anything in the Vanuan toolbox that you should never rush into, it would probably be strategic relocation. Not suggesting that anybody rush through anything necessarily. It's not like Rayo said elsewhere, don't make those cataclysmic leaps of faith, or however he phrases something like that. You know, it's like take a step at a time, you know, one step at a time. Right. But if there's anything I would personally suggest really kind of taking your time on, it's strategic relocation, because it's just so much dry data and there's not really a way of getting around it, nor should there be, because the dry data is actually what's important. You know, I mean, do you really want to relocate somewhere where you're basically going to be impoverished by property taxes? Because, and this segues nicely into the other one, the related article, Shane.
Right.
You know, if the property taxes are too high and you haven't figured out how to increase your income and or you're not financially independent yet, that's setting yourself up for failure too, folks. So the idea here is to kind of avoid or prevent problems and so forth. That's why with strategic relocation, it's research, 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 plan, plan, plan. And then when you're ready, make the move.
Exactly. Exactly. So let's talk about making a move to, you know, private property. What did Ray have to say about that? He said, quote, "Well, I often squat on public lands," and he puts public lands and private property in quotes. While I often squat on public lands, I have found private property useful in some situations, especially for unattended parking of a four-wheel vehicle and for storage of other things too big and or not valuable enough to hide really well. I make these suggestions. Don't try to substitute legal ownership for physical invulnerability. Land you own is not truly yours. The state will try to tell you what you can or can't do with it and will tax you for the privilege. Depending on local regulations, you may not be able to legally build a shack, put in a septic tank, plant trees, cut trees, shoot game, or grow crops without special permission from the various bludge agencies. Your land may be condemned and taken away from you for a freeway, a dam site, or a wilderness area. Ownership does not even constitute a bona fide lease from the state, since the state can unilaterally change its terms at any time," end quote. So yeah, you know, Ray is right. No nuisance abatements? Yeah. So yeah, if you're going to, you know, move out and set up an intentional community somewhere, might want to do that in an unincorporated area. Might be wise. yeah, you know, he makes some interesting points here. You know, can you really say that you own the property if you have to pay rent to the government each year? I don't know, man.
Well, in order to fully unpack just that one paragraph would probably on it to get more into like the lawfare of it, the use of the government's laws in order to oppress people violently and such. The background information for people who may not know a lot about eminent domain or nuisance abatement, as you put it as well, and some other related things, would probably take a little mini series in and of itself. But suffice it to say for here, Rayo is mentioning eminent domain. That's the whole condemning part, you know, taking it away from a freeway, dam site, or wilderness areas. That's eminent domain. The local regulations where he's mentioning about building a shaft, the septic tank, the trees, and so forth, that's definitely nuisance abatement, period. I mean, that's a wonderful, more colloquial way of putting it, but that's nuisance abatement to a T. And of course, That very last sentence about the ownership does not even constitute a bona fide lease from the state, since the state can unilaterally change its terms at any time.
Right.
Well, the only reason why eminent domain and nuisance abatement are problems is because, and this is the foundational concept that permeates through this, and this is why we really don't have any secured property rights even legally, is because America, much like England, was set up on the fee simple system instead of a lodial title, because only the king, the sovereign, the monarch, the ruler, the state, actually has a lodial title to the land and can basically do whatever he or it wants. You, the common serf, the subject, the American citizen, you don't have a lodial title to the land. You only have title only to the extent of it being in fee simple, which is why things like eminent domain, actually, it's even worse than that, Shane. Remember, eminent domain is constitutional. Like, I mean, it's right there. So that's kind of really problematic for a lot of reasons. So, I mean, as was kind of mentioned in season one, argumentation ethics, I think, is what kind of establishes the private property ethic and so forth, you know, axiomatically a priori and all that. But of course, the state doesn't obey that. The state violates property rights right from the friggin' get-go. And that's before even we get to the issue of like collecting taxes and such. Just even in terms of assigning of what lawyers would call property acquisition and titling. It's already messed up right from the get-go, because you don't have it in a lodial title. You have it in fee simple. And oh, by the way, folks, when you own, quote, this is why Rayo put it in quotes, when you own it in fee simple, that really only means you own it at the whim of the state. So, for example, if you don't pay those property taxes and you owe the back taxes,
exactly, yeah.
the property can be, and this is what Rhea was kind of implying, the property can be, the real property, let's say 5 acres, can be confiscated by the state in payment of the, quote, back taxes. But even if you did pay up your taxes, you can still lose the land because a bludgy didn't like how you were using the land vis-a-vis nuisance abatement and or... Even if you were paying the taxes, even if you were obeying the local regs and therefore nuisance abatement, they couldn't even accuse you of that. There's still eminent domain, which really is up this the ace up the state's sleeve. So if there ever was an argument in favor of neo-nomadic living, this would be it, because basically we're all gypsies, whether you like it or not. No, think about this. Well, I don't want to go on too long about this because there's some other things we need to kind of get to for purpose of this episode. So maybe this would be more appropriate for season three. But suffice it to say, for here, we're all Americans are gypsies because of the fee simple system. And for those of you who imagine that the legal system with its systematic use of lawfare that justifies things like democide, at least in certain circumstances where it's appropriate, of course, that you think that you have secured property rights, even those of you who come from old money, those of you who imagine yourselves to be blue bloods because your folks were, you know, you're whatever related, like daughters, like a DAR member, Daughters of the American Revolution or whatever. You only enjoy that stuff at the behest of the state. Because
let me ask you this. I guess this is kind of just something that popped in my head, you know, just kind of like maybe not something we need to really go into much here, but So if it's based off the fee simple system and there's really no such thing as protected property rights, then isn't it safe to say, because, you know, one of the foundations of, you know, kind of the private of, you know, kind of, I guess the free market kind of, you know, ethic is, you know, private property. So if there is never any private property as far as, you know, land, was there ever a free market in the so-called geographical location known as America?
There was only a free market in the context of like personal effects and manufactured goods and things that are inherently mobile. For example, the shirt on your back really is your property, literally. The land that you store your wardrobe of clothing on is not your property. Do you see the difference?
Yeah.
And so that's the problem with government. That's the problem with the state. They always have some sort of hold over people, whether it's some sort of more emotional sanction of the victim type thing, vis-a-vis, you know, Stockholm Syndrome with the state or controlled schizophrenia. Please see season one episode on controlled schizophrenia for more information on that topic. Or even for people who are broken away from that kind of emotional mind control type stuff, the other forms of control, the use of hard power, would be through ways like through the legal system, such as the monopoly on land ownership, real ownership. And so, yeah, when people make noise about secession this and secession that, well, that's all well and dandy and sounds like fine rhetoric. But when you get to the actual nitty and gritty of it, especially if you're talking about things like private cities, please see previous episode on private cities and free ports and so forth. Yeah, if we're not talking about property acquisition and titling, land titling, we're not really talking about you know, setting up some sort of a libertarian. Yeah, even with something like a Liberland. Okay, it's like, well, where was the land where was the land titling on that one too? So it's not just recognition from foreign nation states. It's also, well, even within the legal system of whatever legal system you're operating under, what kind of ownership are you even dealing with? Because remember, there's like 20 million different types. And so in terms of – and so to kind of bring this right around – bring this full circle to kind of your question. So let's say you have a manufacturing plant. Yeah, all those manufactured goods really are the property of like the stockholders of the company who invested it and so forth. You know, for people who haven't read Human Action by Ludwig von Mises, please do. And so, yeah, all that's true. The part that's the ace up the sleeve, in a manner of speaking, is that the land on which the manufacturing plant is firmly rooted into the ground, those private property owners who've had, even if they had that manufacturing plant, let's say, oh, in Detroit, for example, all those car dealerships. Remember that Rust Belt? Yeah, they never owned that land ever. It was owned by the state.
So let me ask you this, and we're sorry guys, we're gonna go on a little bit of a tangent here because I'm fascinated, and I think they probably are too. So how would this the fee simple thing play into things like secession then? Do you know what type of role that would have, considering it, you know, would it be, you know, the private like the property of, you know, the, you know, the, you know, the local state, the state, or, you know, the federal state? I mean, could you kind of elaborate on that if you have any idea?
Sure. And I do think it is relevant to Rayo's article on the acquisition of private land, and why he was putting it in quotes, because I think it's fair for me to speculate that he understood this in the way that I'm trying to explain it to you all right now, where the whole notion of land ownership under the current government's legal system is a freaking joke, because it's largely transferred from the English monarchical system. Look, you and I are considered by the state essentially as chattel property. We're only there to basically enhance the wealth and prestige of the king. And the only real difference at most is that, you know, there was the whole symbology about breaking the crown of the king and spreading it to, quote, the people, which is actually not what happened. It was spread to special interests who used to lobby the king, who were themselves courtiers and now in our democratically constitutional republics are now just a bunch of lobbyists and other special interests of various kinds. That would be an episode unto itself going through all those 20 million different details. But suffice it to say, the actual legal basis for land ownership is exactly the same. The only real difference at most is that there's a greater, or I should say a lesser, disenfranchisement, whereas before some aristocrats were allowed greater land ownership titling, but they still had to obey the king because he only had a lodial title to it, versus now where you have people that can basically be like their own little mini aristocrats and still enjoy it under the fee simple system. But of course, when you add in a further complication like the whole mortgaging, because now, oh, it's so normal to get a mortgage for a house. Look, aristocrats never got mortgages, at least not normally, if they wanted to have real power to then kind of wield with the king. Or at least try to, because remember, aristocrats would go to war with kings when it was over something serious enough, when the risks were worth the bloodshed and loss of life and such. So no, this isn't like a little issue. And it's funny, even if you look at like, as a side note, even if you look at like Mexico's history, people would often deride either side of a conflict in Mexico, of any of its wars, as, oh, you just have the Mexicans warring over a piece of dirt. And it's like, yeah, if you want to be kind of disparaging, I guess you could say that and say with a straight face, but that's not what was going on here. What was going on here is who's going to be in charge and what is the legal system going to be? And because Mexico, much like the American South, is, or at least was, largely agricultural, it is an issue literally of life and death.
Wow.
And that's and that is before we get into historical stuff like the Industrial Revolution of transitioning from agriculture to manufacturing and so forth. But even if we were, well, those manufacturing plants have to be physically somewhere. So unless you're going to have manufacturing plants out on the ocean, and maybe that would be more appropriate for season three. Suffice it to say, ladies and gentlemen, land ownership is really critical to issues of human liberty, or in this case, VANU. And so, yeah, there is. So, yes, I would assume it to be the case that Rayo kind of understood the legal ownership of allegedly private land in much the same way I am trying to condense a lot of very complicated information as quickly as I can. So, yeah, when you factor in additional factors like mortgages, which is a further insult because a mortgage literally means death pledge. And of course, there's the interest to bankers. And so that complicates things further, enhancing the power of the servile society and the state and all of that. It's like, well, even if you were to pay off the 30-year mortgage, it's like, well, you still only have an allodial title anyway. So you're still getting gypped. Or even if you skip. Well, even if you skip the mortgage thing and let's say somebody left you a nice inheritance, or maybe you won the lottery, or maybe you were or maybe you became financially independent first and then decided to buy some land and or a house or whatever, it's still only an allodial title. See, this is the problem with the state chain, is that it's almost impossible to fully and completely win from start to finish. And it's because people don't want to take responsibility for their own lives, and they want to, you know, have everything being done for them like they're a bunch of irresponsible little brats. And one of the consequences of that is that farmers who have to grow, who choose to grow crops in order, whether it's for their own profit or if they're doing subsistence farming and trying to feed their own families, they don't even own the land. Why do you think, sorry, I'll end this rant in a moment, but I think it is relevant to the subject matter. Why do you think there were all those stories even before the Great Depression about subsistence, not even for profit, but subsistence farmers losing their land, not just to bankers because of the mortgage issues, but there were other ones who were freeholders that did own the land free and clear, at least in terms of mortgages. So it wasn't an issue with the bank, but there was the state coming in and creating the dust bowls and so forth. See, there's a whole nother history going on here about why there was stuff like the different sagebrush rebellions, which now has been perverted, thanks to the Patriot movement, has been perverted to mean all this stuff about how wonderful public land is. So it's like, wow. So, yeah, I know. I'm sorry. Sorry, I don't mean to kind of do all of that dump all at once, but it is relevant. But that is relevant, I think, relevant background information to why Rayo here, why Rayo here is being very dismissive of the notion of private property ownership of land under the current government system of its constitutionally democratic republic. It's because it's a freaking lie. That's what it is. Your land is not your land. That's why in the article he's putting it all in quotes.
Yeah. Okay. So it literally comes down to, you know, fee simple versus allodial title then. Okay.
In one sense. However, remember, the state is also inhabited by people who are controlled schizophrenics. So in terms of property rights, which is what we're really kind of getting at here, yes, the clothes on your back, anything that's mobile, what the state call, what the lawyers call personal property. That really is yours.
Hey, the commies call it that too, right?
Possession's not property, right? That comes straight from the syndicalists. Yeah, you damn betcha. That's exactly right. However, if it's something that's called real, what legally called real property, stuff that's firmly rooted, not mobile, such as land, such as even including stuff like a house, where there's a firm foundation, like in cement. Yeah, not quite exactly the same as personal property. So when Rayo, when he was formulating the whole notion of VANU and mentioning about, hey, mobility is actually important, there was some background information. I think it's reasonable for me to speculate and assume that he was operating under that I understand, but it's seldom even explained. So yes, it's important to have all this background information so you understand why there are certain methods like the neo-nomadic living and others which were – that he was experimenting with and try in order to try and have in trying to be invulnerable to coercion and so forth, rather than what you would what actually is a current thing now, which I still think still has some value, but like being an off-grid homesteader, which is something that Rayl was not exactly promoting at any real point because he was still living in the van and so forth.
Huh. Yeah. Okay. You know, that's fascinating stuff. I mean, I've heard those terms before for handling, you know, titles and stuff, but I hadn't heard that explanation, you know, kind of laid out like that. And you want to talk about, you know, pulling the wool over people's eyes. I mean, Jesus Christ.
Yes. And so
the out and open tyranny, you know, such as, you know, like civil asset forfeiture and, you know, just, you know, breaking into someone like, you know, the no knock raids of just beating someone, like, you know, killing a whole family or whatever. I mean, that's bad enough, but it's a lot worse than that.
Oh, it's totally worse than that. And not to belabor the point too much, because there is more to get into in Rayo's article on acquisition of private land. But just to kind of sum up this more background information, at some point, I need to really finish my book on lawfare because people just don't get it. Thankfully, there have been other libertarians and other people who have screamed bloody murder about evils like central banking. You mentioned civil asset forfeiture a minute ago. Democide, that's a real thing, and that's good. But it's also the more subtle, or shall I say, daily tyrannies that are in some ways more insidious, because not everything has the flashy trappings of somebody being murdered by a cop, because there's the more subtle stuff about what like lawyers and bureaucrats do, whether, you know, judges and whatever else. That's the more subtle stuff. And the judges in particular in the court cases, for anybody who actually bothered to find it, will in many cases, sometimes they'll obfuscate it and have a lot of legalese and such that Fred Rodell said be careful of because they're trying to hide the truth about something. But there's other times where the judge will straight up say, yeah, you are ruled. You are property of the state, basically. And so are your children, because that's the basis for it. So if the children are property of the state, well, their parents were children at one point too. It's kind of like reason it back to the root causes here. Not that hard to figure out if you actually sit down and read some stuff, think about it, talk to some people who know what they're talking about, and you can pretty much figure this stuff out. Doesn't take a genius IQ.
Right. So it really is true. You know, the phrase you said, well, I'm going to drop a bunch of these old phrases here, but you know, the devil really is in the details.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. We've said many times before. I mean, Rayl was an engineer. He was far ahead of his time on a lot of stuff, and you know, he's obviously very well read. So you know, the reason he chose mobility, there had to have been a damn good reason why he decided that, you know, mobility is that's the only way that, you know, or that's the best way to be invulnerable to coercion. So there's probably, you know, a very, very, you know, good understanding of exactly what you're talking about, which, you know, led him to do those things. So it's probably kind of a no brainer, right?
Yes. And in order to kind of flesh this out more, we should go through the rest of the article. But I figured that kind of brief as possible background information is really kind of important, because that's getting into lawfare, a particular form of lawfare, yes, but that's getting very much into the lawfare type material, where if you don't understand that, then it's kind of like, well, why bother living in a van, which we'll do a few an upcoming episode on here in season two. Yeah, there's actually reasons why Rayl is putting, you know, certain words in quotes, like private quote land, quote private property, quote, and he's being rather dismissive, is because I think he kind of understood the stuff in much the same way I do, or at least very similarly, where a lot of us have been fed a lie about and it's also, I think, why a lot of people become socialists, is because they too, to a certain extent, understand that the legal system's notion of property rights is fake and phony as a $2 bill. The problem, though, is that when you combine that truthful realization of theirs, but you combine that with their economic illiteracy, then they become socialists. In other words, their reasoning goes something like this. Well, because we don't really own anything anyway, we might as well just have everything go public, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's another reason. It's not just an emotional reason or appeals to help the poor or whatever. It's also, well, we don't even have secured property rights anyway. Even the free market people say that, therefore socialism, pretty much. You know, it's kind of like swinging the pendulum kind of a different way and so forth. But yeah, that's, I mean, Rayl kind of understood this whole fee simple thing. At least I think he did.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's. I'm sure we can, you know, dive into that, you know, a lot more as we get through some of these, you know, excerpts that we're going to read, and it will be the entire chapter. It's a very short chapter, maybe a page and page and a quarter, page and a half, something like that. But you know, I think it's important to get his reasoning here, and also some of the things he advises when it comes to, you know, on an acquisition of private property. Okay, so quote: lease instead of buy if your expected use is short term, a few years or less, and preferably lease from a sympathetic landlord. This can save a lot of hassles, end quote. So, you know, leasing, I mean, you don't own it anyways, right? You know, leasing, I guess not having to deal with a lot of that extra stuff that would be tossed onto, you know, homeownership. Yeah, that certainly save you a lot of hassles.
Yeah, it's kind of implying that, well, kind of like how you rent an apartment, you just rent the land and have just somebody else basically interfacing directly with the state, and that helps keep you, I think is pretty much what he's kind of assuming here.
Okay. All right. Next one. Quote, count the purchase price as an expense, not an investment. Taxes on visible property are the only taxes easily collected and will tend to rise to the rental value of the property, wiping out equity. Income and sales taxes are increasingly evaded and or destroy their economic base. Property taxes are already one-third or more of rental value in much of the U.S., often in excess of rental value in New York City, resulting in abandonment of thousands of buildings. Of course, some lands may increase in value in the short term, but land speculation, along with speculation in stocks, commodity futures, rare stamps, horse races, and poker games, is rationally left to full-time professionals, end quote. So that's an interesting way he put that. So he's talking about property taxes are already one-third or more of rental value in much of the U.S., okay, often in excess of rental value in New York City, resulting in abandonment of thousands of buildings, okay? Okay, so he's kind of talking about, you know, kind of the financial aspects of this too, okay? Interesting. What do you think?
Well, I think Rayo's being very wise here, and there's an old adage which – for certain is now completely incorrect. The old adage was such and such being as safe as houses. The idea basically being where home ownership is always a safe investment, which of course, even before the Great Recession, so-called, of circa 2007, 2008, 2009, was a complete lie. You know, the American dream has been explained to us by the Madison Avenue social engineers is a complete lie. You know, getting the Servile Society's notion of essentially getting the 3-bedroom, 2.5-bath house in the suburbs with a white picket fence and the crappy, van, not a good van, but like minivan type thing. And of course, the appropriate amount of, two boys, Protestant family household, WASPs, in other words, is a complete and total and utter and blatant lie. Because, of course, there's different kinds of family structures and not everybody wants a white picket fence, suffice it to say. Mm-hmm. I think it's very important to keep in mind that another part of the reason why Rayo is saying count the purchase price as an expense and not as an investment is because land speculation, much like any form of speculation, as you understand, Shane, right, as well as I do, considering, you know, some of their activities we're engaged in. Speculation is a form of gambling.
Yeah.
It's gambling, period. It's like playing you even mentioned it here, poker games. You even said poker. That's a good way of putting it. It is poker. So any form of speculation is a form of poker. It is gambling, period. So saying something is as safe as houses, when the whole notion of using your house as some sort of investment asset that'll appreciate over time is complete bonkers, because the assumption is that the trend will only go up in terms of the house and or the land on which the house is will only appreciate in value in terms of it always going up. That's bonkers. Because it could go up, but it can also just as equally go down. It depends what the conditions are. It depends what the demand, the market demand is, and so forth. And
depends
so
on if there's a huge housing bubble about to pop, all that sort of stuff too, right?
Yeah, whatever those. Sure. And if there's government intervention, as Mises mentioned in Human Action many, many times, if there's any sort of government intervention, that further complicates things. And usually when I say complicates things, I mean usually in the sense of things go down badly. So that's kind of something that's rather interesting. And also consider something too, even if there was no government in the sense of people believing in the mythology of the state and so forth, and it was, and it really was an unregulated, untaxed, unlicensed, laissez-faire free market that we're pretty much dealing with. Free markets are permeable. You know, there is such a thing as creative destruction, which also means there is no class system. If people were actually allowed to produce and not be controlled and all that, and people were allowed to, you know, buy and sell and trade and so forth. And it's not always with money, right? Because dating on this continent is still thankfully a free market. Thankfully. God, can you as a side note, can you imagine bureaucrats trying to regulate people dating?
Put in a permit, yep.
Oh,
I
want to
go on a date with Jane Smith on Friday at 7 p.m. Can I do this? All right.
Yeah, can you imagine paying taxes just to get into a nightclub on a particular night? I mean, come on. But apparently when it comes to anything else that involves production of real goods and services, apparently people in the servile society are more than okay to, for the most part, may complain every once in a while, but on principle, they're okay with taxes, regulations and laws and such. And it's just kind of like, really? Really? So again, to bring back full circle, in terms of counting the purchase price as an expense, not as an investment, yeah, because Rayo understood the whole thing is jacked. It is jacked. I mean, it's kind of like assuming that if you have a savings account at a bank that collects interest, or even a checking account that collects interest, it's like, but then by the time you pay the taxes on the interest from the checking account, it pretty much cancels out. So at that point, if you were going to have a bank account, you might as well have a non-interest-bearing checking account, which actually makes more sense. It's pretty much the same thing, except with less accounting. I mean, at that point. And so I think Rayo kind of took a similar perspective here. You know, just treat the land just as you would an apartment, and you can save yourself a lot of grief and, you know, math and, you know, adding, subtracting, multiplying, and dividing.
Right. Yeah. That's a good point. It's a good point. And he continues kind of along the same line of thought here. Quote, lease or buy wasteland to keep purchase prices and taxes low. Avoid commercial farmland, commercial timberland, and land close to cities or recreational developments. One more here. Quote, obtain only a few acres but close by a national forest. National forest is in quotes too. I like that. Back to it. Obtain only a few acres but close by a national forest or other large stretch of unowned government-owned land as an access port for foot nomads, trogs, end quote. So, yeah, you know, probably a good recommendation. If you're close to a city, I mean, yeah, you might be, you know, liable once the city wants to expand, you might be liable to eminent domain. That's wise. Commercial farmland, commercial timberland, if there's a way for a corporation to lobby the government to, you know, use eminent domain, yeah, I mean, that's not unheard of. That hasn't happened before. I think those are some good recommendations. Certainly some good recommendations.
Yeah, as opposed to buying supposed land on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, right? You know, where it's like absurdly overinflated and whatever else. But yeah, the I think it's kind of interesting that he's mentioning also about, you know, either the so-called public lands or whatever else, almost like kind of like an escape route in a sense. So if you had to flee the private land, you can just go to the government lands and kind of hide out there for a bit, or use it as a form of kind of like an unofficial easement. So if you had to go from like one allegedly private property to another private property because you're getting swat. What's the term? Swatting, I think it is.
Swatted, yeah.
Yeah, where somebody gets swatted, you know, and for people who don't know, that's the practice of essentially where somebody essentially cries wolf to the police and they send a SWAT team to basically murder your family. And it's funny because even the cops don't even want to necessarily do it. They're just like, well, we have a tip. And then it turned out that the anonymous tip was completely lying and or there was ulterior motives, like they wanted to get revenge against somebody. So they used the government as their own personal billy club. Oh, yeah, amazing how often that happens.
There used to be a trend with gamers who were live streaming where, you know, hackers would get like the IP address and then like find out what their address was. And then they'd SWAT them there on live stream as a joke. And it's like, you've got to be kidding me. Like that happened, you know, quite frequently. And, you know, like teenagers got arrested. I guess I thought it was funny. But, you know, having, you know, a bunch of goons knock down your damn door isn't really a joke, though. But yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's kind of, just kind of as a side note, yes, they thought it was so funny when basically the modern version of the Gestapo basically gets to enact government tyranny at someone else's expense. Because tyranny is always funny when it happens to someone else, of course, don't you know? But it's never funny when it happens to you, because you're above it all. You're the Uberschmen. You're above it all. You're protected by the government. The government will protect your property rights. But it's always funny when somebody else's property rights get violated, even if it's the exact same type of property rights and so forth. Because again, it's the controlled schizophrenia one more time. So let me put it this way. If the shoe is on the other foot, do you think those black hats would be laughing just as hard if they were getting swatted?
No, I'm sure they wouldn't. No.
Yeah, and as far as I'm concerned, they're just you know, typical criminal types, like a mugger or a rapist or a thief and so forth. And so, yeah, I mean, I guess the only real at that point, I guess maybe they're two or three steps away from organized crime, maybe if they were to even bother getting a little bit organized, I guess, in some sense. Right. Maybe even do a little bit of central planning. Right. Here's where we're going to centrally plan our, like, you know, our enterprises, red market enterprises and such. Yeah, please see previous episode on ethical enclaves for what red markets are. But yeah, I think that's kind of interesting that it's the disingenuousness involved. And so, yes. So regarding what Rayo said here about being close by a national forest or other large stretch of unowned slash government owned land, right? Because the government can't own anything. It's not a human being, right? Then, yeah, it's almost like he was trying to think of like an exfil point too, or whatever that term is that soldiers use, usually black ops or spec ops guys.
Well, there'd be lots of escape routes, you know, if you're by thousands upon thousands of acres of, you know, land where no one goes to. If you had to escape, if you had to pack up his, you know, polyethylene A tent, you know, hit the woods, there's plenty of space to do that.
Yeah, so essentially a way of bugging out, essentially, or more precisely, you know, infiltration points and extraction points or rendezvous points or whatever the heck the spec ops guys call it. I'm sorry, folks. I was never in the military. I'm just trying to kind of make sense. There's a lot of weird terminology.
Don't apologize for that.
But I mean in the sense of getting, like, the accurate terminology of the men who wielded the firearms and the bombs and the guns and whatever else in order to defend us for our freedoms, of course.
Defend our freedoms after all that was been revealed so far in this episode. God. Okay.
Right.
Let me read this next paragraph. This one's related to what we're talking about here. Quote, get land with trees, brush, and topography adequate to conceal anything you may leave on the surface from habitations, roads, and the air. Some counties are reportedly aerial mapping for tax assessment purposes. End quote. So kind of along that same line. I mean, all of his suggestions are, you know, we're trying to get invulnerable to coercion here, as invulnerable as we possibly can be. So, you know, here are the things that are, you know, are good. Yeah, you know, having some air cover, you know, for tax assessment purposes or other things. People like to grow things in the forest. You know, probably don't want to, you know, that's found, might make you more vulnerable to coercion. So, yeah, obviously another, you know, wise recommendation from our boy Rayo here.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the guy's name, and I'll probably remember it at 3 a.m. or whatever. But yeah, there was that infamous case back in the 90s where it was the rich fella and the National Park Service wanted basically to steal his land. And the pretext that they used was that they actually got out like one of those Cessna planes and flew over his house. And they basically lied and claimed that he was growing cannabis. And thus they used that as the basis for basically SWAT teaming him and totally killed him in his own home and all that. And wow. I think they ended up burning the house down, and his widow was interviewed by the mainstream media, and it was like this big sob story. But then at the same time, like, she was basically homeless for a while or some such thing. I'm trying to remember the guy's name right offhand. But yeah, it was a big famous case. And so, yes, what Rayo is mentioning here is kind of interesting, because in some ways it's almost foreshadowing. It was like, yeah, you know, I'm sorry, but that thing that happened, you know, later in the 90s, because Rayo wrote this in the 70s, it's like, yeah, he's kind of foreshadowing a lot of that stuff, right? At least in some sense, like, hey, you know, get the air cover, because if not, you know, you might end up as what's his face, right?
Yeah. Okay, now these next ones are where it gets kind of interesting as far as we've already gone over all of the all of the issues with all of the reasons why there's really no such thing as private property when it comes to land nowadays, just as Rayo kind of realized back in the 70s, maybe before. And now we're going to get into if you're purchasing so-called private property, how do you do it? What are the steps that you need to take? And obviously, as a disclaimer here, this was written, a while ago. Some of this stuff probably isn't possible. I'm sure, a few years ago, signed all the papers to the house I live in now. And, I think it's getting more and more sophisticated and a lot more shady shit going on when it comes to the housing sector, to the real estate industry. But here's what Rayo had to say as far as recommendations kind of along those lines. Quote, purchase in the name of someone, real or otherwise, who has few dealings in the servile society to minimize chances that the land will be confiscated as a result of lawsuit, unpaid income taxes, etc. The owner is preferably a woman, not subject to conscription, not expected to be employed. First, check out the purchase procedure. Is ID required to purchase? To sell? Must purchaser appear anywhere in person? End quote. So as far as those questions, is ID required to purchase? I don't even remember. You have to be there to sign. Yeah, you have to be there to sign anyways. All that stuff is, the paperwork is pretty in-depth now. You can't just hand over the cash and go your separate ways. There's still a lot of paperwork. I think his questions here, I think those are kind of, irrelevant now, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think we can pretty much answer this in the affirmative. IDs required to purchase and to sell, and I do think you have to appear in person, if I remember correctly. Let me put it this way. Buying real property, whether we're talking the land and or a house, is pretty much in many ways very similar to like buying or selling a car. Everything's got to be above board. There's all sorts of bureaucratic regulations. It usually tends to be pretty expensive in at least some relative sense. This isn't like going down to some sort of big box store and just buying something off the shelf with cash and walking out the door. It's not like that at all. There's paperwork. There's bureaucratic legalese you have to get through. I mean, it's a big deal.
And especially if you go through a real estate agent, because they have their own stuff that they have to comply to. If you're going to, like owner to owner then you might be able to avoid some of that stuff. But I really do, especially if you're paying cash to them, I'm sure, there will still be. It's land. It's land. And, as Rayo said in the ethical enclaves, for something to easily be taxed or revealed to the government at all, one party has to consent to that. And obviously the person selling the land, considering it's on paper, everything's there, he's gonna have to pay taxes on that, and he's gonna tell them exactly who bought the land. There'll probably be paperwork with it and all that stuff. So I think it's pretty safe to say that you're gonna have to reveal some personally identifiable information in order to purchase land. So
well, at least tentatively, I know some privacy advocates elsewhere have mentioned about maybe forming dummy corporations to act as interfaces. But again, that would be more appropriate for season 3 in terms of determining whether that would also
play really nicely into Vanu and Cities too. But a little foreshadowing there for you guys.
Yeah, a little bit foreshadowing, and that's perhaps more appropriate for season 3. But at least for now, in terms of Rayo's immediate questions here, it's like, yeah, unfortunately, it's all got to be done above board in terms of the legal system and so forth. So, yeah, buying land, buying a house, buying a car are all kind of very similar. Shane, they're also very similar for one very simple reason, actually. Even if you were to do it peer-to-peer, owner-to-owner, as you said, the main problem and the main thing, even if you were to kind of skirt around some legalities, the one thing you absolutely cannot get around, and it's the same for a car as it is for a house or land, is transfer of title.
I knew exactly where you're going with that. Yes. Or else you don't own it, right? If you don't register with the county assessor or whatever.
Yes. And so that goes for the cars as well. So even if you were to either skirt around the taxes or the owner increase the price of the property, but only to the degree of covering the taxes on his end, so his butt's covered, or however you negotiate the contract, essentially. And even if you were to skirt around some other things or rearrange it, whether in a gray market sense or a black market sense, please see previous episode on ethical enclaves. In any context, there's still one gosh darn it legal maybe not an interstice, but a legal type thing you really can't get around, at least not easily, which, of course, is transfer of title. Transfer of title of a so-called motor vehicle, which in Texas is defined as in the way that it is, which is kind of really annoying. The so-called motor vehicle, which is only a motor vehicle when it's actually on the government roads. But on private land, it's not a motor vehicle. Again, topic for another time. But yeah, it's
everything at once. It's a motor vehicle. It's not a motor vehicle, and it's both at the same time, and it's none at the same time as well.
And this is why I don't like lawyers, and because they all pretty much work for the government, and at least in some sense, officers of the courts, they're known. I have to get a license to practice law, and oh boy, that's really a topic for another time, because I could go on for hours about the legal profession just by itself. But suffice it to say, for now. Yeah, there's transfer of title. So whether it's transfer of title of a so-called motor vehicle, transfer of title of a house, transfer of title of even just raw, undeveloped land, the point is that at some point the government is involved in the execution of the contract, of what would otherwise be a private contract. So yeah, practicing communism much? I mean, this is what democracy is. I mean, Hans Hermann Hoppe got it right. I mean, to paraphrase the man, basically democracy is communism light. Or socialism light. I mean, however you want to view that spectrum, the point is that it's all kind of different shades of gray of a fundamentally the same type of authoritarianism. So yeah, I don't know about you guys. I don't want to basically join a institution that forces me to wear a green uniform so I can murder foreigners so that those who falsely imagine themselves to be my rulers can essentially dictate how land is going to be used that I don't even own. I mean, it's so many steps removed. It's like, okay, do Americans really enjoy being chattel property? Because so far they seem to be pretty much okay with it. Because taxes are the price right. Because taxes are the price we pay to live in a civilized society. Somebody actually told me that on Anarchy Day, by the way, when I was at work.
Oh, that's typical thing. Civilized. What's civilized about a society foundationally based off of, coercing your fellow human being, not directly but indirectly? I mean, that's civilized. Come on.
Yeah, and government itself is inherently based on slavery. And so when people, not to go off too off on the philosophical stuff, because we want to stick to the private land thing, but suffice it to say, yeah, that's what government is. Government is basically slavery. It's that is kind of the hard truth of it. And of course, if you disagree with the massa, they'll just straight up kill you. That's what democide is. And so people expecting the massa to respect their property rights is just kind of silly. Now, there have been concessions that have been made, but the only reason those concessions were made is so that it serves basic – this is the more economic side of it – but basically it serves as an incentive for those of us who are considered chattel property by the state to be more motivated to be more productive and produce more meat and milk for the rulership. That's it. That's the only reason why a democracy even tolerates a moderately free market is to basically provide a greater feeding trough for the parasitical state. That's it. That's the only reason.
Right.
It's to have a more productive tax plantation. And even monarchy worked exactly the same way with the kingdom. The kingdom is just this tax plantation, and the same thing with a democracy. So in terms of fundamentals, nothing has changed at all. And one of the proofs of this, why it's relevant to this episode, is when you look at the legal system in terms of land ownership. So when Ray was putting stuff in quotes, yeah, and not only that, but when he's saying things like use a proxy or rent the land, this is why he's saying this kind of stuff.
Right, right. Let's go ahead and move on to this this next quote here. So we're going to be on the same subject. We can certainly come back to anything we want to. Quote, don't use land as a mailing address nor as legal home address on driver's license or other ID. Don't have a mailbox there. Don't have a telephone there. Maintain these addresses elsewhere. Caution everyone who uses land never to mention it as address. Bludge agencies cross-check each other's records more and more. Get on file with one and others will come asking why you aren't doing this and that. End quote. Let me see here. Yeah, let me go ahead and just read this next one too. It's close enough related. We're talking about so-called private property here. Quote, don't make permanent visible installations or improvements. Limit surface structures to vans and trailers. Do not connect to commercial electricity or other utilities. If questioned as to land use, land is unoccupied, unimproved, for occasional recreational use only. Hide vehicles as well as possible. Also move occasionally, end quote. I think there's a couple interesting things to point out there. Yeah, as far as, you know, with this digitized world, if they have one address, they have all the addresses, right? I'm sure they would. I don't think he's wrong about why you're doing this or why you aren't doing that. An interesting thing you mentioned in the second one was do not connect to commercial electricity or other utilities, which would be he's telling people to live off grid, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
I guess that's kind of the most interesting point that I thought. You mentioned you never really talked about off-grid homesteading. Well, maybe not directly, but if you're going to purchase, private property, don't connect to, commercial electricity or other utilities. It's an interesting little proposition there.
Yes, yes. And I think it's kind of important here about not having a mailbox or whatever. This would be a topic probably more appropriate for season 3, but kind of a little bit of foreshadowing. There is the issue of paper tripping. And one of the things that people do when they paper trip is that they use things like mail drops and whatever else to establish legal residence, not where they actually live, and so forth. And so in some ways, in terms of alternative identification, if you will, where your legal residence is actually can be rather creative, shall we say. Because, of course, as anybody who's been homeless knows, trying to reestablish legal residence can be rather quite problematic. However, if you're a normal middle American with a K, you already have your legal residence. And so like the next evolutionary step beyond that, in order to help you become more of a newer, is to have a legal residence that is not where you physically live, which is what Rayo's basically kind of advising here. And not only that, but he's also stressing, keep this kind of stuff compartmentalized, right? Because he's mentioning about cross-checking each other's records more and more. And see, he wrote that in, I think it was 72. So if the Bludge agencies were cross-checking each other's records more and more in 1972, how much more are they cross-checking now in 2017?
Well, it reminds me of, first thing that comes to mind here is, Adam Cash's Guerrilla Capitalism, when he was saying, if you claim this amount of deductions with, the feds or that amount with the state, you better make damn sure that whatever you're turning into each agency, you're, giving them the same information. And this was like in the 1980s. But the reason being is because, they compare those, to try to find tax cheaters. If they're inconsistent, I mean, they're going to, they're going to come asking some questions. So that's kind of along the same line as what Ray was kind of saying here.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And so, yeah, I think Rayo's advice here about and especially where he mentions elsewhere here about the visibility issue, because remember, that was something that happened with the Costilla County off-grid homesteaders back in, I think it was 2015 or so, was that area in the San Luis Valley, everything was very flat and very wide. Again, it's a valley, right? So it was very easy for the nuisance abatement cops to basically go around and harass the off-grid homesteaders and all that, as opposed to if the terrain was noticeably different, where there would be, shall we say, natural obstacles that would obscure visibility from the Bludgies, then that would increase their invulnerability to coercion and basically be the opposite of the situation where those Costilla County off-grid homesteaders and the San Luis Valley were actually more vulnerable to coercion because everything was so highly visible. There were like virtually no natural barriers. I even saw that off of Alex Ansary's footage where you could see literally for miles and miles somebody's poor shack. So, yeah, it was like ridiculously easy for the county bureaucrats to go and harass those poor people. So, yeah, when Rayo is saying here about, make sure to kind of keep stuff out of line of sight, hell, even with the lawyers, if we're talking about like Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, what the lawyers themselves have called the plain view rule. In other words, like during the context of a traffic stop, anything that the cop can see is fair game and doesn't need a search warrant for.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah, no, that's, and I guess I will, along the same line, I mentioned, you know, that intentional community. That second one I heard of, you know, comes, you know, that might be starting up pretty pretty soon here. So yeah, you know, if could make a recommendation, you know, deep back in the woods somewhere, you know, maybe, you know, a few mile road back there, where, you know, nothing that's happening is visible, might be a wise thing, you know, to keep, keep the bludgies at bay.
Well, at the very least, regardless of the specific type of environment, it doesn't have to be woods necessarily, although I know what you mean by that. And it is a common phrase. But the main thing is natural obstacles, whether you're down deep in a ravine or you're up high in a hill country or heck, I mean, if the whole, you know, if the private city people can get their act together, I mean, who knows, maybe like an underwater city on the seafloor might be possible someday. You know, I mean, hell, that water, and I think I explained this on an earlier episode, Shane, I'll repeat it here because it is relevant to the natural obstacle thing. The water from the from the ocean surface to the bottom of the sea, that itself is a natural barrier. So that's the main thing, natural barriers. Wherever you're strategically relocating to, please, for goodness sakes, try and get yourself an area where there are natural barriers that you can use as a shield against invaders and bludgies and such.
Right, right. Okay, this next one, all these are obviously closely related. Quote, minimize use of access roads to minimize attention. Commute to town weekly or less often, preferably on the weekends when there is maximum foreign traffic, and during darkness when vehicles are not easily identified. End quote. Actually, well, this next one too, same thing. Quote, get land with heavy brush to discourage interlopers. Build extra bushes as necessary to encourage any hikers to go around rather than through your important places. Artificial barriers, more elaborate than a chain across the driveway, are seldom worthwhile. A high electrified fence may keep out an occasional hunter, but will arouse curiosity as to what is going on. A well-concealed warning system will be of value if people live there often, end quote. Okay, yeah, and that is the last quote that we have. So kind of along the same line of thought, and I guess one kind of new thing he brought up was, you know, the commuting aspect. There's people coming and going all the time. I mean, that's a lot of traffic. That's a lot of, you know, that's pretty pretty obvious. Pretty obvious.
Yeah, especially if you have the secret police or even the not-so-secret police on a stakeout and they're surveillancing people's comings and goings, even if it's on their own driveways and or easements or whatever, especially in more rural areas, usually tends to be easements, not not so much private driveways. But that's a nuance a lot of people don't understand. But yeah, if they're doing like a stakeout type thing or whatever else, then yeah, Rayo's... See, what Rayo's kind of suggesting this entire time here is basically different methods of, like, anti-surveillance. So, like, how do you obfuscate, basically, if you were under surveillance, like, you know, two bludgies in cheap suits in a, I don't know, what's the typical FBI vehicle these days? What, Crown Vic, maybe?
Maybe, yeah, yeah.
Or maybe like the Chevy Interceptor if they got a little bit of money, because some police departments do have those. So I guess the FBI could spring for those for their special agents, because the special agents are special for a reason, like the Special Olympics.
Super special, yeah.
Yeah, quickly, yeah, you know, put them in Nerf, right? Or else they'll fall over and shoot themselves with their own firearms, right? And that's and folks, that's also a side joke too, because there's also been studies done where people with concealed carry permits are actually better shots than law enforcement officers are on average. So yes, the putting the FBI agents in Nerf suits is actually not completely serious. Let's just say an unrealistic joke. But suffice it to say, yeah, when Rayo's mentioning here about heavy brush to discourage interlopers. Again, natural obstacles. And he goes on to mention about building the extra bushes. You know, there were some relatives of mine from back in the day, and I'm talking about like late 90s, who would basically, instead of having a fence, they just basically planted like rows of trees. And the trees were the fence. And yeah, it was aesthetically more pleasing than just a wooden fence. But it also kind of served kind of more or less what Rayo's mentioning here about artificial barriers versus he even says build extra bushes. Yeah, that's also known as like planting trees, hopefully ones that'll mature quickly as opposed to ones that will take years and years and years, which is like, OK, well, what do you do in the meantime kind of thing? But he's also right, too. Like if you have a high electrified fence, it does arouse curiosity. Right. And also, sorry, one other thing I just thought of. If you look, you were mentioning like the doomsday preppers, quote unquote, earlier or whatever. You know, the problem with a lot of their setups And of course, their hold out, there's a deeper issue predictive programming wise why they're hold on the mainstream media is because it's to ridicule people who actually care about self-sufficiency. But those different so-called doomsday preppers, their barriers and their structures and all that are in such a way more often than not and actually intended to arouse suspicion, actually, especially like I think there was like two or three of them that actually live in missile silos. Which, don't get me wrong, in terms of, you know, defense against being directly struck by a nuke is actually pretty cool. But, you know, do you really need to invest all that money in again buying your own, you know, decommissioned missile silo?
Right.
So there's that, too. And yeah, if you look at the missile silos, as the cinematographers for those different episodes of that so-called show, really demonization hit pieces, showed, and this part was accurate if you know where to look. You look at those missile silos from the outside, they look like government installations. They look suspicious as all heck. I mean, it's almost like inviting like, hey, Jimmy, let's go, you know, slip through the electrified fence and see what the government installation's hiding this week. So, yeah, if the so-called doomsday preppers, those few that are in the missile silos, want to keep people out, it's like, only if the horror of the Cold War, really the Second Cold War, well, there's a topic for another time. Only if the horror of the Second Cold War actually does come to fruition, then yes, you may want to get a bunker that is, you know, like with reinforced concrete several feet underground that is resistant to direct, not just indirect, but direct nuclear strikes. Other than that, I'm not going to suggest to people to go try and invest in decommissioned, you know, nuclear missile silos. Just saying.
Okay, so if any of you were, you know, considering pondering the idea of decommissioned missile silos, hopefully Kyle discouraged you from
because they attract
investing in such a
because they attract attention like nothing else. And it's interesting, like you can tell. I mean, this is like one of the great blunders of government architecture. I mean, guys, look at like the J. Edgar Hoover building in like D.C. It is freaking ugly. Even some government county buildings right here in Texas, even in East Texas, where I used to live, those buildings were like designed in the 70s and they are ugly. They are an eyesore, some fierce. And not only that, they're so ugly, it's like circus freak ugly, where it attracts attention. Like you're driving by and like, oh, there's a Wendy's and oh, there's some like typical buildings and oh my God, there's a government building. It's such an eyesore kind of thing. The missile silos are kind of similar.
Yeah, if that was, you know, a business or, you know, someone's piece of private property, they'd probably, you know, run them off the land and tell them it's not fit for inhabitancy.
Yeah, nuisance abatement, right? It's nuisance abatement. But of course, nuisance abatement doesn't apply to the government installations, of course, because they're above the law. The very laws they force us to obey, which is why their architecture can be an eyesore. But oh, if you have the slightest thing out of place, well, we have to fine you like $200, you know, a day or whatever for each violation and infraction and such. So, so to get back to what Rhea was kind of mentioning here, yes, I think the natural barriers, or at least in the sense of a somewhat aesthetically more pleasing barrier, let's put it that way, whether it's a row of trees or, as he put it here, brush and such, he's right on the ball. I agree with him like 1,000% as far as that goes. And then, of course, it's just more an issue of, well, what kind of barriers are better than others? And again, that would probably be more appropriate for season 3.
Right. So let's begin to close out here. So I think this is kind of evidence, you know, especially, you know, kind of especially with that extended discussion there when we started, you know, talking about this article, you know, as far as strategic relocation to, you know, just a piece of private property. Well, it's, you know, just as we've kind of seen, you know, throughout, you know, his writings, he had little faith in legal interstices, little at all. You know, obviously, you know, sometimes they're unavoidable. Sometimes they can help you. But as far as, you know, the private property, it seemed like, you know, you know, he kind of just viewed that as kind of unnecessary. You know, why deal with it? Why just go live in a van or, you know, do the wilderness Vanu thing? Or, you know, hell, get a sailboat or, you know, move somewhere else where maybe they do have some allodial title. I don't know. That'd be an interesting, you know, research kind of investigation for season 3 to find out, you know, what countries are under allodial title. You know, he had little faith in legal interstices, and especially so when it came to private property.
Well, yeah, because what interstices there are, and there are some under a fee simple system. Okay, let me kind of maybe give a little bit of a positive note here. There are some But then that's the other side of it, is that there are some. It's not actual private property, or what the state would consider itself to be, or would consider in its legal codes and such as a lodial title. It's not the same. It's not the same. And for people to basically act as if it were the same. And yes, I know there's the adage about, well, I own X free and clear. It's a half truth. It's true in the sense that, yeah, you're not, you know, you don't have a mortgage to bankers, or otherwise you have a loan to a bank and all the 20,000 million different problems associated with that. That part's true. But again, this is more the legal side of it in terms of the again, property acquisition and titling. What is the nature of the title itself? And it's like, okay, well, if you own it free and clear, that means you're not indebted to bankers. Good for you. But the lawyers have you in a bit of a vice grip.
Right. And I think with this episode, especially, I mean, we focus pretty early. We kind of started out, you know, talking about, you know, the strategic relocation, you know, more generally. And, you know, after this entire discussion, you know, this was unintentional, too. You know, Kyle and I got together. This is what we always do. Like, we get together, you know, we have our scheduled times. We'll get together. We'll do the outline in like 30 or 45 minutes and we'll do the episode. I mean, yeah, this was unplanned, but it seems like, you know, we're kind of setting ourselves up for, you know, the newer, like the next kind of ones we're going to look at, especially for, you know, strategic relocations, as far as like van nomadism, country shopping, and the sailboating, you know, going over all of these issues, you know, really, even before we get to those, makes those look a lot more attractive.
Yes, and it was also, and maybe I should have mentioned about the fee simple and all the legal issues with land ownership maybe earlier. I don't know, but this is really the first time it's been seriously mentioned, so maybe this was appropriate in terms of timing. But in terms of like the earlier miniseries we did, like with the localized areas of liberty and all that, and
yeah,
why I was,
yeah.
You see, there was also a deeper reason why I don't, I'm not exactly a big fan of private cities, because how are you going to get the allodial title? And there's like no answer. And it's like, okay, well, you at that point, those guys sound a lot like the guys who want to secede, because the secessionists don't have an answer about, okay, you want to secede, okay, fine. How are you going to get the allodial title? No answer. You know, it's what Ayn Rand herself called the blank out. You ask a really serious question about something that actually is relevant, and there's no answer. Blank out. So basically, it's kind of like, you know, many of the typical libertarians will accuse statists of doing, where you ask them a real question regarding the nature of the state, or
like, how can you delegate a right that you don't have to someone else?
Blank out.
Yeah,
blank out. Yeah, blank out. And by a similar token, many of the libertarians who promote some types of things like private cities or secession, etc., when you ask them about, okay, and I've done this too over the years, private conversations. This is actually, by the way, this is the very first time I'm mentioning this publicly, by the way, but I'm just so fed up and it is relevant to the subject matter. Might as well go on the public record for the first time here. In private conversations, I've asked secessionists and the private cities type people and versions thereof, how are you going to get a allodial title to the land that you're going to be establishing your new country and or private city on? Blank out. They do the exact same thing that the authoritarians do when we ask them issue questions about roads and whatever else. And so there's a maybe not necessarily controlled schizophrenia, but it's an uncomfortable coincidence. At least I think so.
Well, there are plenty of other issues with the secessionists, but that's just me.
right, but it's the blank out. It's the blank out. It's just the there's no answer, and then it's just arbitrarily.
It's not really a serious suggestion. I mean, yeah,
right.
they may repeat it every single day, but it's not. I mean, it's just kind of a catchphrase at this point. It's nothing more than that. I mean, no one's really seriously. You know, proposing that idea or doing anything to bring it about, and gosh, don't take that as like, oh, so we need to go out and you know try to get secession to happen. Please don't. No, I'm just making a statement here. We don't need any more political crusaders, but just a statement. Like, they aren't going out and doing anything about it. They aren't recommending people do anything about it. It's just kind of a catchphrase, like secede to the individual. And it's like, okay, what the hell does?
I thought,
whatever.
But wait a minute, Jane, you and I have canceled our voter registration. I think that's
pretty much
the closest thing, and that is actually a legal interstice, a real one, a provable one. You and I have already done, I did mine in 2013, you did yours, sometime between then and now. And and other people too, right? There's other people who have canceled their voter registration too. And that's documented now on the public record. But then, of course, the political crusaders just hop, skip, jump over that, right? And because they would rather talk about their thing, which doesn't work, whatever the thing is, whatever the crusade is of this for this particular week. And you ask them some even one question that's rather pertinent, again, to reiterate, like, how are you going to get the allodial title when you get your private city and or you secede? And no answer, blank out. So that's kind of an uncomfortable coincidence with what the authoritarians similarly do when they blank out when we ask them questions about their philosophical justification for the state and so forth. Blank out, no answer, just, you know, screw you kind of thing, kind of implied. You know, how dare you even ask the question? It's like, well, geez, you know, so much for intellectual honesty.
You're hurting the movement.
Oh, don't get me started on collective movementism. Oh, and by the way, and for the folks, please see season one episode on collective movementism as far as that goes. And also the other season one episode, too, about political crusading, if you haven't listened to that one yet. But yeah, whether it's that version, the other version, or whatever the heck else, it's like, look, man, I really do care about, you know, the future of human liberty, or in this case, Vanu, right? And in order to try and make it practically happen even more so than it already is, something, you know, it's kind of you have to sift the wheat from the chaff, you know, what works from what doesn't work, at the risk of sounding like a utilitarian, because I do believe in, you know, natural rights and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, it's just, or at least argumentation ethics, right? I just want people to really seriously think about the forms of direct action that they are promoting and whether it's actually A, consistent within itself, and then B, whether it actually has a snowball's chance in you know what to actually survive and make it and accomplish its goals. Because I really do want people to, you know, advocates of liberty to be successful. But it's a little hard to push for any sort of success if they just want to have failure after failure after failure, because they can't even answer a simple question like, here's one or two ways in how we're going to get allodial titles. So we're going to do this, we're going to do A and then B and then C. And if A and B don't work, then we'll try D. Like, there's no explanation. It's just blank out. And so, yeah, kind of as a strategist myself, I just get kind of frustrated. And it's like, okay, so we really can't talk about these different topics, whether they may or may not be direct action, because they're not even, they don't even, can't even answer a simple question that actually is relevant. Right. And it's just kind of problematic. And so, yeah, when Rayo's having little faith in legal interstices, it's like, yeah. Yeah, you know, because of the government's lawfare, he was right on the money. And again, I can't emphasize this enough. This was back in 72. Okay, nothing has changed. This isn't some new thing. It wasn't because of Barack Obama or Donald Trump. This is the system as it is normally. You know, the elected officials may come and go, but the bureaucracy is permanent.
Indeed, indeed. Well, on a more positive note, I guess to maybe close this out a little bit. So, like earlier on, you know, a survey of Siskiyou Region. When if you read that article, Rayo really loves the government maps. Like he just, you know, he talks about them a lot. Like, you know, here are the topographical maps. They're just fantastic. Is pretty much what he's saying. But keep in mind, you know, they didn't have the internet back then. But if you're, you know, considering strategic relocation, well. You know, you can get all those maps for free on the internet. You can print them out, you can view them, you can, hell, there's even interactive ones where you can kind of just scroll around. Like if you're choosing like three or four locations, why don't you print them out? Just, you know, go to those locations and kind of scroll in, look at the topography, all that good stuff. You can get those for free on the USGS website. And that's United States Geological.
It's the United States Geological Survey. Yeah. And yes, those topographical maps are it's not MapQuest, ladies and gentlemen. These are real maps, but by real, what I mean is that they actually are showing physical features of the land itself. So it's not political maps of like, oh, here's the board, the artificially imposed political border between government area A and government area B. Let's say the difference between like Texas and Louisiana, for example. No. This is about here's the elevation of this hill. Here's how steep that hill is. Here's how flat this other hill is. Like real features. Like this is like one of the very few times I'm actually going to compliment the government on something, because the surveyors can't fake stuff like that. They actually have to go and tell you, okay, there's a creek over there. There's a lake over there. real features of the actual land itself. And so that's the value of topographical maps. But unfortunately, apparently it would seem to be the case that there's no private sector version of it still, at least not from what I can tell. And so, yeah, it's pretty much the United States Geological Survey, an entity of the federal government that produces those topographical maps, which I'll admit are incredibly useful.
Indeed, yeah. Yeah, so if that's something you're looking into, you know, strategic relocation, you might want to take a look at those. Those might be, a very high value to you. And they don't cost you – well, I can't say they're free. I mean, you know, nothing government does is free, right? It's money that's stolen.
It's
money. So you aren't going to be stolen from and then charged for it again. So we'll put it that way. So there you have it. That is kind of a good note. I mean, those could very, very much help you in your pursuit of Vanu if you're going to be doing this sort of thing. So – you got anything else to leave listeners with, Kyle?
I would just say this. When you're thinking about strategic relocation, I would, in some sense, disagree with Skousen and agree more with Rayo, in the sense that if you are going to strategically relocate, I would not suggest strategically relocating in the sense of like buying some private property in like this specific neighborhood, preferably rural area, although that's debatable between some people, right? The topic for another time, whether rural versus urban versus suburban, right? Or suburbs and such. It would be more, think about strategic relocation more in the context of like a region, much like what Rayo did. You know, he did the survey of the Siskiyou region, and you can do surveys of different regions, right? I mean, heck, there's a book I'm actually reading right now that I got from the socialist local public library. You know, mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. Okay, and everyone done snickering. Yes, I do use the public library. But yeah, there's a book I'm reading right now on buying rural land in Texas that's more dry and academic. But, you know, just one or two examples real quick. So, for example, it'll mention that like where I'm at in the Hill Country, which is basically central Texas, the nearest 10th millionth in terms of acres, there's about 19 million acres. That's rural land alone. And or if you go out to, let's say, Far West Texas, which is basically like that's like Odessa, Midland, even El Paso. That's like 16 million acres. Heck, South Texas, which is pretty much let's just say the border region, the Rio Grande, if you will. That's like 21 million acres. That's rural land. And what's also interesting too is there's different purposes of that land. Like, for example, like right here in the Hill Country, 13 million acres of that land is specifically for the purpose of like native pasturing. So it's interesting. So what I'm trying to kind of say is this. If you're interested in strategic relocation, what you may want to consider doing is try to see if you can find books or other types of materials that are specific to the region that you are looking at to relocate itself. So, like, for example, this book I've got is more about rural land in Texas. It's a little broad, sure, and it's more about confining itself to, like, the political borders and such, but it does look at different regions of Texas and break it up, because North Texas is not the same as East Texas. Completely. If Texas was to be broken up, even politically, there would be different and distinct regions. Because the South is not the same as the Hill Country, which is not the same as West Texas, which is basically a desert. That's Odessa, Midland, and El Paso, which is also not the same as East Texas. And of course, the DFW area is kind of its own nightmare because of the traffic and such. In terms of strategic relocation, think about regions and regions according to not political borders, but regions in terms of like the physicality of the land and the climate.
And for gosh sakes, don't confine yourself to, you know, just this geographic location known as America. I mean, there's a lot of land out there here on Earth. And hell, there's a lot of ocean, too. So, yeah, don't confine yourself to just, land here in the geographic location known as the United States. There's a lot of fun. We'll certainly get into more of that stuff in later episodes. But certainly a great example. You know, if you're looking for a place, well, I guess anywhere you go. I mean, if you're looking to, find some, rural place in Ecuador, I'm sure they have some books there. On purchasing land or whatever, there's going to be some resources, but, certainly a good recommendation. I just say, don't confine yourself to, just, geographical locations here in the United States, unless you've already kind of made your decision and you're just trying to learn more about it. But if you're trying to learn more about it, you probably shouldn't make a decision yet.
Although to be fair, Shane, I think that was a little bit of foreshadowing, because I think that's starting to get it a little bit into country shopping, isn't it?
Yep, that is true.
but yes, strategic relocation is where you're essentially moving somewhere else, voting with your feet to basically mitigate threats and risks against you and your family. And that's kind of the long and the short of it. And then just the rest of it about how to do it is a combination of looking up dry data and figuring out, like, what kind of lifestyle do you want to have in terms of climate? Do you want to be a desert rat? Do you want to be snowed in like 9 months of the year in some areas, right? Sorry for people who live in Wisconsin in the Midwest, but sometimes, you know, do you want to live in an area where they have to throw salt on the roads? That's a real question. People don't think about stuff like that. Or do you have to get like a wood stove because it's really, really cold, especially if you live off grid, like how Rayo was kind of implying that you should if you're going to get that allegedly private property. Like, there's all like these 20 million different questions. And instead of running off, as Konkin put it, the anarcho-Zionism, mindlessly, I should say, and especially in the context of a local congregation, instead of all that, how about you consider for yourself and or your family that, hey, you know, maybe we would be better off living, I don't know, hypothetically, let's say the South, because there's lots of sunshine and crops grow there, like tobacco and whatever else. And that would be a better environment for our family, where we don't have to pay money for firewood to keep us warm, and there's not a lot of salt being thrown on the roads and whatever else, right? So it's all of those like 20 million different considerations that don't involve things like cost of living adjustments.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So anything else, man?
I would say kind of that's kind of the long and short of it. So, yeah, strategic relocation can very much make you more invulnerable to coercion, as long as you're careful about it and you take your time. And then when you're ready, move.
Well said. Well said. So that's all we have for you. Next week, we'll cover the subject of, drumroll please, country shopping. So if you enjoy the podcast, please consider shooting us a donation. VonniePodcast.com/donate. We accept PayPal, Bitcoin, altcoins, or you can make a monthly contribution via Patreon and reap the benefits that come with that. Oh, and I know there's some benefits. You can get a monthly email from Kyle. I mean, you'd love getting emails from Kyle. I get them a lot. I always enjoy his emails. So you will too. His emails to you will be on the subject of Vanu. So more kind of the developing of season 3. A whole bunch of other stuff. You can have private Skype chats with us on the subject of Vanu. Just all sorts of cool stuff there at patreon.com/Vanu. We certainly appreciate any assistance in getting the message of Vanu out, financially or otherwise. You can always just share the podcast, send a link to the website, all of that good stuff. So thanks so much, y'all. We'll talk to you soon.